Hey guys, how you doing? It's Coach Treggs here, the founder of 30 Plus Men's Fitness, and I hope you're all doing great. Welcome to episode 19 of the 30 Plus Men's Fitness podcast. We've really got the wind in our sails now in 2017. I promised at the start of the year to bring you two a month, but right now I'm actually giving you one a week. That's how much I'm enjoying them. I've been reaching out to a lot of my peers. They've all agreed to come on. So we're actually, you'll be listening to this one today, and there's still a queue of more podcasts coming out. Now, I'm joined today virtually, of course, with another guest, somebody that I started to follow on social media probably about 2.5 years ago when he actually did a video condemning bulletproof coffee, which is actually what I was recommending to my clients at the time. So he sort of sparked my interest and I started to follow him. I thought, yeah, this guy knows his stuff. He seems like a great guy. So I recently reached out to him and he agreed to come on the podcast. So I'm sat here today virtually with Ben Carpenter. How are you, Ben?
I'm very well, thank you, mate.
First off, Ben, thanks for coming on the podcast. I know you're a little bit nervous about this, so I've had to sort of say to you off camera that we're not going to get too sciencey. We're just going to have general banter and chit chat and hopefully give my listeners some value.
That's fine with me, yeah.
Awesome. All good. Okay, guys, so look, for those of the guys that aren't on social media, you know, they might have just started listening to the kind of stuff I do. Tell us a little about who is Ben Carpenter for those that don't know.
So I've been a personal trainer, I mean, all of my adult life really. I was on a course when I was 18 and I turned 30 last month. So I've been a personal trainer for just over a decade now.
Wow.
And it's pretty much all I've known. The fitness industry is my passion. It's what I love. And, you know, that's what I dedicate myself to, really.
Where are you based, Ben?
I'm in Oxfordshire, in Banbury.
Okay, great stuff. I know it well. I'm originally from Gloucestershire, so I think we used to play football out Banbury way.
I'm sorry to hear that.
It's terrible, mate. Yeah.
Not the prettiest part of the world.
So look, buddy, you're like a sponsored athlete now, and you're all over social media, etc., etc. But you said you're 30 now, right? Or 31?
Just turned 30.
30. Okay. So hence why we've got him on the show. Tell us a little bit about where it started for you with health and fitness, because I speak to everyone and I say, look, where did this begin? I remember first going to the gym when I was like 14 or 15 with my mate on our mountain bikes and we were hooked. Yeah. Where did it all start for you, dude?
I was in sixth form at my school.
Right.
And a leisure centre was built literally on the same ground. So it was a 1 minute walk from the common room. And you know, when you've got gaps in your day and you're doing a couple of subjects and you know, maybe doing 3 hours of studying and then you've got gaps between clients, it started off more of a kind of hobby, almost to fill time, really. So I was about 16, 17, I guess. Kind of got really into it, started seeing progress, started feeling a bit better about myself. And it was almost like a snowball effect, you know. People compliment you on looking good and then you wanted to look a little bit better. And it, you know, it's probably about 99% vanity.
Cool. So were you like a slim, like, cause obviously you're in great shape, you're ripped and stuff like that, but were you sort of a skinny guy or what were you like before you started? Or were you always sort of quite naturally athletic?
No, I've always been a little bit of a skinny guy. Like both of my parents are very, very slim.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, I was one of those guys that I was always athletic and I played football and cricket and badminton and loads of sports like that. I always enjoyed staying active.
Yeah.
But, being muscular or, you know, more muscular, it's not like I'm massive or anything. But that was kind of weight gain rather than weight loss for me.
Sure.
Not a naturally muscular person.
And so in terms of like a program, did you follow anyone in particular? Was it a program you were just going in there and just doing like 3 sets of 10 on every machine?
Well, the funny thing is I did get given a program, but
brilliant.
That is basically what my program ended up being. When I went in there was a fitness manager who was in really good shape. You know, he looked like a bodybuilder, but nowadays he probably isn't that big, you know, how perspectives change.
Yeah.
But I looked up to him because he was the only guy in my small town that really looked like he lifted weights. And he gave me a program which ended up being 3 times 10 on every machine.
Yeah. And how did you find that?
Well, I mean, he gave me a routine, that the type of routine that he did, and you know, he'd been training in the gym for years, so I was absolutely crippled every time I did it. And it was really, really fucking difficult. And I remember being in agony when every time I trained, but you know, at the time you don't think anything of it, you just assume they know better.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it, and it was hard, and I ended up being in the gym probably a couple of hours at a time because the routine was so long that you know, it got my foot in the door, and in hindsight it's all fine, isn't it?
So I mean, so that was like when you're like 16. So did you obviously made up your mind then that you wanted to get into the personal training industry. So that obviously just setting foot in that gym sort of sparked you into thinking, right, this is the road I'm going to go down, or did you have that on your mind before?
No, it did kind of spark it. Like when I was in sixth form and kind of doing A-levels, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And, you know, I had friends that were going off to uni and friends that knew what job they wanted, and they already had their career paths mapped out. And I was one of those guys that never really knew what he was going to do. And I enjoyed two subjects more than anything else. And one was IT. I was always a little bit of a computer nerd. And then second was I had a passion for fitness. And for me at the time, I thought, you know, on average, people in IT probably earn better.
Mm.
But I thought, I just can't bring myself to sit in front of a computer 8 or 9 hours a day. I just, for my own personal preference and mentality, I thought it would probably, you know, kill my soul.
Sure.
So I thought, well, I enjoy fitness. I seem to have more passion for it than anything else. So, yeah, again, it kind of snowballed, really. Like, I started off doing it gently and then enjoyed it more and more. And then, you know, after about 2 years or so, it just became like an obsession, I guess.
Sure. So you went straight from sixth form into doing like a personal training course, right?
Yeah, so I started the Premier Training International course when I started when I was 18, which 5 days I think before my 19th birthday, which means I got it half price, which was nice.
Nice.
So kind of fully qualified when I was 19, and then went straight into a self-employed role at LA Fitness, and you know, I've been self-employed ever since, really.
So you started off at LA Fitness in Oxford, right?
Yeah.
And how was it, like 19 years old? Because I did a whole career change when I was 27, so I actually didn't start PTing until I was 28. So I suppose you could say I was a bit more sort of worldly, a bit more grown up. How was it going in like a rookie, 19 years old, and getting clients for yourself?
It was scary. I think I probably started with almost like a false sense of confidence. But, you know, a lot of guys, like we did a weekend business course with LA Fitness before you start, and they kind of just tried to teach you the ropes and systems and things like that. And they actually said that young guys had the highest kind of percentage dropout rate.
Yeah.
Because when you're starting your own business and you have to approach people on the gym floor and kind of drum up customers, they just said, you know, young guys are often, you know, more shy, maybe a little bit more awkward, maybe haven't matured as much. And it is quite difficult to just say, okay, you're on your own, go out there, find clients. It was quite intimidating. And after probably 2 or 3 months, I thought, you know, I hadn't built up that much of a business. And I remember talking to my, she was like the area manager at the time, and she said, the problem is you're copying what the other PTs are doing. Like, if they were sitting around, I was sitting around with them, thinking that was kind of part of the, you know, I was kind of almost following their schedule. And she said, no, you need to go out there, make sure you're talking to as many people as possible, you know, help as many people as possible. And if you do it well, you'll find that clients come to you. And that's that. I've got a lot to owe that advice, because if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't have managed to make it.
Excellent, dude. No, it is very scary starting out on your own. And I was quite lucky, because I came from sort of a marketing background. I used to organise music events and stuff like that. And I've always been a bit of a walking, talking self-promotion machine. So I had sort of and I had that sort of marketing know-how. And I was like, you know, when I started out, I don't think we had Facebook, Ben. It was like Google AdWords. That's how I got busy. But yeah, it can be quite daunting. I think you're quite right. The dropout rate is actually quite frightening. People go into it, and they think it's just going to be easy. Yeah, there's just fitness. We don't realize we have to actually go and market ourselves, right?
Yeah, I read a couple of really good business books that kind of flipped my perspective on it. And one of them, you know, basically people get often get into the fitness world because they enjoy the gym or they enjoy fitness. So they approach it with a passion, but often approach it with literally zero business skill. So a lot of people start and they're like, oh, you know, I enjoy working out, so it'd be great fun to be a personal trainer. And then when they start there on day one, don't have a fucking clue on what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because the actual business side is, you know, a very, very distant second to just the fact that they enjoy working out.
Yeah.
And that's basically how it was with me. I enjoyed working out, but I had no idea what I was supposed to do to get clients and that type of thing.
Let's talk about, like, when you started off, because I still remember teaching my first ever PT session, and I kind of look back now and go, oh, jeez, I can't believe I did that. And, and I was talking to you slightly before we started recording, and, you know, we've all evolved, and I think it's quite refreshing now in the industry. You see a lot of trainers coming out and saying, well, maybe I was wrong on certain things. And I've often, you know, my stance has changed on a lot of things, and I say, look, I make no apologies, because you only know what you know at the time. And I still got clients' results. I've been getting client results for 10 years. But it's funny how we evolve, right? Do you remember teaching your first PT session? And also, what sort of nutritional advice were you giving these guys? Because we were taught, like, the food pyramid, right?
Yeah.
On the PT course. And it was like 6 servings of, like, carbohydrates a day, like, for the general public.
Yeah.
Go on.
Like, when I think back to stuff like this, it gives me nightmares because it makes me realize how tragic the advice I was giving was. I remember my first clients. I remember the kind of programs I gave them. It's almost like I've got so many funny and embarrassing stories, I don't even know where to begin.
Come on, mate. Come on. We've got an hour. Come on.
I remember, so when I started, I remember, this is no word of a lie, I remember when I started, and obviously on the PT course, you're taught about resistance training, and you're taught about cardio training, and modalities of training, all the kind of, let's say the technical stuff, like energy systems and things like that. And I remember having one of my first clients come in, and she said, oh, I want weight loss. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't actually know what I do with a resistance program at this point. Like, I got taught how to make training programs and, you know, different exercises and stuff. And I got taught what to do nutritionally. But I remember just thinking, I don't actually know what I do with her in the gym if she wants weight loss. And just having this, like, you know, the very first hurdle, having this complete crisis of, I was like, God, I've got no fucking idea what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And obviously what it does, it kind of taught me safe ways to execute exercises and things like that. But it didn't really ever go into, you know, how to customize programs for clients and things like that. So when it actually came down to having my first clients, it was almost like a bit of a random mishmash of exercises.
Yeah.
But in reality, there's actually very little thought process behind it, because I didn't understand, you know, anatomy and physiology enough to really feel like I was customizing something to them. So it was almost like blind guesswork, just because I couldn't, you know, I didn't know enough about it to really know what I was doing.
It's really refreshing that you admit doing something like that, because I think it was where a lot of, when we start off as PTs, I remember actually, like, you're almost having this kind of, like, brain block and thinking, I can't just walk somebody around the machines, you know, it's not jazzy enough. And, like, buying Men's Health and Men's Fitness and, like, going through it, like, on a weekend thinking, right, I'll do that. And actually, like, cutting it out and sticking it to pieces of paper and think, like, I think we're talking 10 years ago now. But you only know what you know at the time, right? And sort of, you know, moving on to the nutrition, like I said to you just then, you know, we were taught this whole food pyramid, and it was like I was going to, like, overweight ladies, right, you know, you want to get your cereals for breakfast, and then mid-morning it's a brown sandwich, and then you want some pasta for lunch, and, you know, people were getting fatter.
Yeah.
And I remember being told that, look, by a good friend of mine, Renzo, who I wrote a program with, and he said, like, I bumped into him when I passed the course 10 years ago, and he said, remember, Treggs, he said, these courses are very much a base.
Yes.
You must go away and learn and keep learning every day, like, because these courses literally get you a piece of paper, but please go out there and go deeper, right?
Yeah, I think that's a, a critical one, really, because a lot of personal training courses, like you say, they'll give you a certain foundation, but actually going out there and thinking of yourself is very different. So for me, when I did the first personal training course, I had almost like a false sense of confidence because I was qualified and, you know, I'm a fully qualified PT, or that's, you know, what you think. But believing that fully qualified means fully knowledgeable was massively different. Mm. So, you know, it only took me a couple of years to look back, where it wouldn't have even been that, a few months to look back and just think, what the fuck was I talking about? Like, I just have no idea.
Mm.
And it's so easy in hindsight to look back and think, I actually had no idea what I was doing, training-wise, diet-wise. And, you know, if I've been doing this for 10 years, I honestly could not keep count of the number of things that I look back on at cringe about the mistakes that I made with clients.
That is so refreshing. It's so refreshing. And actually, I spoke to Phil Learney recently, and he said exactly the same. He actually said it was like, you know, when you go back to your folks' house and they get out like some of your school books from like 10 years ago and you've done like paintings and pictures and you're like, fucking hell, was that me? Shit, was I really saying that? But we only know what we know, right? And we evolve. And I think it's nice. I said to you before we started, there's more of a, it's a refreshing wave of honesty from a lot of trainers in the industry now saying, well, yeah, perhaps I was wrong on certain things. So let's sort of go on to the sort of nutritional side of things, Ben.
Yeah.
What kind of nutritional advice? Because, you know, we're talking, this is way before My Fitness Pal and all that kind of stuff. What sort of advice were you giving to, say, your average person coming in wanting fat loss back then?
Well, not originally when I passed my PT course, but shortly after that, as I continued learning quite aggressively and felt like heavily aligned myself with low carb dieting, and it, you know, to the point that I would have described myself as a kind of low carb zealot, where carbs to me were the devil. They were something that I avoided completely, and it was almost like you get a certain carb phobia.
Yeah,
like calories were irrelevant at the time. It was a case of, if you want to stay slim and if you want to lose fat, you have to avoid carbs completely.
Yeah.
So I remember taking this to such an extreme that if I would look on the back of the label, even if I saw the word sucrose, I literally wouldn't eat it.
Wow.
Even if you look at the nutritional information, there was like, let's say, a gram of carbs per serving. So you could add a tiny bit of sugar to something. And because I was taught that if you see sugar on the label, you weren't allowed to eat it, I would avoid it completely. So I had full-blown carb phobia for, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years or something like that.
So how did that, so what were you basing your diet around? You were sort of like, you know, sort of high protein, moderate fats, almost keto or paleo?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of evolved. I was very, you know, quote unquote, natural diet, paleo diet.
Yeah.
It kind of, it evolved and went low carb. So for a long time, all I was eating were things like meat, fish, vegetables, nuts, like, you know, things that I would still class as wholesome foods.
Good
like
food.
It's not, it wasn't the, it was the inclusion criteria that was the problem, because that's all I would eat. So it isn't a case of going, you know, those are bad foods or anything. It was the fact that I was literally petrified to eat anything else. So, you know, I wouldn't even eat one slice of bread.
Wow.
And things like that. And I had such an extreme, you know, food paranoia about things that it was difficult for me socially, and it was difficult, you know, eating with friends and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the fitness world breeds quite a lot of neurotic behavior, especially with competitors. So you get so used to doing things like taking Tupperware everywhere you go.
Yeah.
And that's almost like a sign of dedication. So in my head, what I was doing was something that I described as dedicated. But in reality, it was something that I think was problematic. Now I look back at it.
Sure. Let me ask you this, Ben, because you've always been pretty lean, right? You've never had sort of issues with being overweight.
Yeah, pretty much. Like,
sure.
Even when I was slim in school, like, I had a tiny bit of a belly, but, you know, not by most people's standards. I was always a kind of skinnier kid rather than somebody who was overweight.
So even somebody that has always been lean, you know, and you were obviously including carbohydrates, you know, as a teenager and when you first hit the gym.
Yeah.
It's interesting to try and get your head around why you became so scared and actually change things, even if you're already lean. Because you can understand why people go, right, who are carrying too much body fat, right, I'm going to cut the carbs, I'm going to do this, yeah, I'll go really low carb. But you're already a lean guy. Isn't that really interesting?
I think I kind of think that what I did was, you have just enough knowledge to think that you know a subject, but not enough knowledge to realize why you've actually got no idea on the subject. So I remember reading about insulin and people saying that insulin inhibited fat loss.
Yeah.
So therefore you avoid carbohydrates because in carbohydrate ingestion raises insulin and insulin would halt fat loss. And for me, that was enough of a knowledge kind of snippet to think, well, I have to avoid carbs then if I want to be the leanest that I can be. But, you know, in reality, it was so much more complex than that. And, you know, that's what I did. I took that little snippet of information and thought I knew a subject really well, and then had, you know, full-blown carbophobia where, you know, I wouldn't dare touch a piece of bread because I thought I'd turn into kind of an overweight and inflamed mess.
So let me ask you this. How did you feel when you went through that couple of years of very low carb? How did you perform? Because that's quite a long time.
At the time, I didn't particularly notice any kind of performance decrements. I think the thing was, because during that phase, my own training kind of evolved.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I was doing hard resistance training and then switched to a very low carb diet and then, you know, saw what happened. It was almost like, you know, there was so much stuff going on that I couldn't really isolate whether it was good or bad or not. So I don't know, in terms of performance, I don't remember thinking, oh God, this is horrible or anything like that. And weirdly, I got used to it. Like, I didn't think this was a super hard diet to stick to. But, you know, now I don't avoid carbs like the plague. If you said to me, I can't touch carbs to the same extent that I used to, like, I can't think of dietary wise anything worse because I got so used to eating them and being able to include them in my diet that, you know, avoiding them unnecessarily seems like hell to me now.
Sure. So were you recommending this way of eating to your clients as well?
I was recommending low carb diets to all my clients. To me at the time, low carb dieting was the way to diet.
Mm.
And whilst I don't think that it is a bad diet or anything like that, it was more of a case of that was the only way of doing it. So to me, it was low carb if you want the best results, and anything else was, you know, kind of second rate. And I, in hindsight, I describe myself as a bit of a fitness asshole in that it was what I considered optimal or it was nothing. So with clients, I was like, okay, this is what I would like you to do. Can you stick to that? And it was very much kind of my way or the highway.
I love this. Yeah.
That was the kind of mentality that the coaches I followed did. So it was like, this is how you're going to diet. This is how you're going to train. Anything else is second rate. So are you happy with that? And that's how it was. And I missed out on a whole load of client results from people that I could have made a small, you know, kind of alteration to that, and they would have been fine with it.
I really, that's a super honest answer, Ben. And do you know what? I look back to before my kids come along about 5-6 years ago, and I said to you before we started recording, I was like, you know, super paleo, CrossFit, and, you know, I'd have lads turning up to my boot camps tired because they got young kids, and I'd be like, fucking man up, dude, what's wrong with you? No, you don't need that sugar, you don't need that. It's paleo, you know, it's paleo way or the highway type thing. And they used to say to me, Treggs, just wait until you become a dad and you're tired and irritable. That happened. And, you know, I found out what exhaustion and tiredness was truly like, yet still tried to limit myself from certain foods and then would end up binging on them because I just couldn't maintain being like a super low carb, clean eater type thing. And when I think back, if I'd have just given myself that little bit of chocolate or given myself that, maybe that would have satisfied the fact that I was, you know, craving those foods. And maybe I wouldn't have ended up, you know, face planting into them on the weekend. So it sort of brings me on to this question to you. You said you went extremely low carb for years.
Yeah.
It was your way or the highway. Did you end up in sort of carb binges?
I had very, very bad relationships in terms of kind of binge restrict cycles. So for me, it was a case of super, super, super strict dieting. as low carb as I thought I could be. I cut out everything that I considered a major source of carbohydrates, and I would do that for a few days, and then I would have a cheat meal or refeed meal or whatever I kind of whatever terminology I wanted to use to justify at the time. But what happened was, as I dieted and my daily calories came down, those refeed calories ended up going higher and higher. And it got to the point where I was on, you know, super strict dieting for, let's say, 5 days. And then I would have the mother of all binges. And,
really?
You know, I could see off 10, 15,000 calories in binge, you know, binge eating.
What, in
and
a day?
I didn't see it as problematic because I was taught that refeeding and having a high carb day or a cheat meal was good for the metabolism and all of that. And I did this for ages and I didn't see it as problematic at the time.
So you would do 10 to 15,000 calories in a day?
Yeah, and I could do that pretty comfortably. So even after, like, say a photo shoot, this was horrible. I remember the first time I really, really dieted to be super, super lean for a photo shoot. Like, obviously you're on very low calories leading up to a photo shoot, and you know your appetite's through the roof, and you're tired and irritable and all of that stuff. And the same with competitors. They will often compete, and because they've restricted themselves with food for so long, they will often have huge, huge cheat meals afterwards. And I remember having this photo shoot and seeing off, you know, I'd got home and have this huge meal. Then I literally had a whole saucepan of porridge just because I felt like I wanted something big. And, like, you know, a saucepan of porridge for most people, they wouldn't be able to finish. But I had that, then a whole pack of brownies, then a whole pack of shortbread, then I think two large bags of Haribo, then a large bar of dark chocolate, then like a whole punnet of grapes. And I literally ran out of food in the house. I ate everything and I could have kept going because my appetite was absolutely insatiable. Yeah.
This is really, really interesting. Really interesting. And the thing is we talk about this whole cheat meal, but that was what we were being told was right in the industry. Cheat meals, refeed, you know, leptin was the big buzzword. And I've actually, you know, again, I admit I've evolved, and I've actually we do generic online plans, and I've actually taken the cheat meals out now, and instead just encouraging people to track if they want to. And because, you know, we used to have we had cheat days in the program, but when we used to do these for women, we would find that women would just go and completely binge. And then it would set them off track, and the next day they'd be like, "I can't stop." And a cheat meal would turn into a cheat week. And I was like, "Whoa!" I said to people I was doing these programs with, "We're creating fucking binge eaters. This is bad. This cannot carry on." It's all very well saying to somebody, "Yeah, enjoy a pizza on a Saturday night," but giving them the green light to just go and binge after they've been so restricted just wasn't sitting well with me, right? And I think finally the fitness industry is waking up to that, right? Would you say?
Yeah, I mean, kind of everyone has their own different food psychology. So, you know, if you say to someone you can have a cheat meal or you can have a quote-unquote refeed or however you want to phrase it, I think people naturally gravitate towards a different implementation of that. So I had clients where if I said, you know, do you want a little bit of chocolate on a daily basis? Will that kind of curb your cravings for chocolate? They would have been absolutely fine with that. And they would have a couple of squares of chocolate and then they would put it back in the cupboard. And then I'd have other clients that if I said, you know, you don't have to avoid it completely necessarily. And as soon as I kind of gave them that window, they would go on a massive, seafood diet, the seafood and eat it. And they would come back and say, I actually had someone that said, as soon as you gave me the green light to have any bad food, they went fucking hell for leather and they, you know, cleared out their cupboard. And even though that obviously wasn't the recommendation, just by saying you can have a little bit if you want, to them it wasn't something that they could deal with, and they ended up having huge, huge, huge cheat meals.
Yeah, and this is the thing, I think you have to be careful. It's not a one size fits all approach with individuals. It's like, if this is, I've often said, I did a video on trigger foods before for my followers, and I said, for me, right, because we've got kids in the house, and, you know, again, I was one of those guys that would go, I'm not giving my kids that, I'm not giving my kids that, and then you have kids and you're fucking exhausted, and you're like, just give them the chocolate rice cake, you know, for a bit of peace and quiet. But, yeah, I actually said, if my missus comes home with chocolate rice cakes and I just eat one, I know I'm in big fucking trouble. I can't stop. I'm in big trouble. So you're absolutely right. Somebody could have two chocolate rice cakes and go, yep, thanks very much for that, cheers, and put them away. Others will go, no, I'm off. And it's almost like you can't stop. Those neurotransmitters in your brain go, boom, and you're away.
Well, I mean, for me, I think I spent my career learning from bodybuilders, like, because I enjoyed bodybuilding and gaining muscle. Everything that I followed was written by bodybuilders. And it was so, you know, you have to do this. That's discipline. So you could give someone a super strict diet where they're only literally allowed to eat six foods and nothing else. And to a bodybuilder, they would say that's because you have to put in the dedication to get it. And to them, that's what they class as dedication.
Yeah.
But to me, that became normal dieting. So I would diet on the tiniest selection of foods. And then, yeah, when it came to eating anything that was off plan, it was just this huge, huge shitstorm of food that I would eat because I was so used to depriving it completely that I'd literally have one square of chocolate and my eating for the rest of the day I'd literally be sitting on the sofa just stuffing my face continuously.
Wow.
And, you know, some people don't do that by any means. But for me, I've spent so long being the, you know, the super strict diet, super strict dedicated, this is all you're allowed to eat, that anytime I deviated with any junk food, it became like a crime scene of food wrappers in my living room.
I think there'll be many guys, Ben, that are listening to this and can relate, and I can entirely. So look, let me ask you this. What changed? What was the trigger for you to go, actually, there's got to be another way? And when was it?
It's a good question. I think it was a gradual process. I remember reading an article. It was an article on flexible dieting. And for me, it was because I did come from like a background of hardcore clean eating. I don't know if that's a term, but it should be a term.
Yeah.
Like hardcore clean eating and kind of hardcore low carb dieting. And it's just everything I did was so hardcore, like, you know, bodybuilding style. And I remember reading this article on how sugar wasn't necessarily bad calorie for calorie. And I remember reading that and having a very big kind of moment of cognitive dissonance when it was challenging the stuff that I had built the last kind of couple of years of my life on. And I remember reading it, and I always like to think of myself as quite objective. And I read it objectively, but it was obviously something very contrary to what I'd been doing. And that was what challenged it.
Right.
And I remember having a huge kind of mentality shift. And then I started looking into it more and more. And I've always said to someone, if you want to know a topic well, try and prove yourself wrong. Because knowing some research to support your argument is very different to knowing all the research that goes in both ways and then deciding your argument. So I looked into it and researched harder and harder and harder. And that was when I kind of thought, yeah, I fucked up here.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, it takes a lot of balls, doesn't it, to actually understand that and have an open mind as to there is sort of alternative ways. And I remember sort of a couple of years ago, probably about two and a bit years ago, sort of seeing this sort of flexible dieting term emerge. And I looked a little bit deeper into it and the old IFYM. And I was like, what? I mean, I was on courses, I'm not going to name names, 5 years ago, and it was like, you know, insulin, you do not want to spike insulin because that's it, right? You don't want to use microwaves because microwaves are going to give you cancer.
I think you might have been on the same course as me.
Yeah, all right, yeah, we'll talk about that off thing, yeah. Toxins, you've got to rid your body of toxins, so you need to, you know, drink all this kind of stuff. Don't eat after 6 p.m., because leptin does its best work at like 1 a.m. in the morning, and you know, leptin will fucking like suppress growth hormone and all this kind of, and you come away and you're like so confused and you're like, wow. And then you're like, you know, you're worried, like you're saying, you're such a clean eater, you're worried about eating anything that's going to spike your insulin.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you see this more flexible approach and you think, fucking hell, like, what do you mean people can have chocolate, this and that? I've been totally against that. And you're like, you're seeing everyone sort of talking about it. You go, no, this can't, they're talking fucking bollocks. And then all of a sudden you start to look into it. And I remember reading, I was watching a thing with Alan Aragon, who actually came up with the whole IFFYM term, didn't he? Because apparently it was bodybuilding.com. I don't know if he was an admin on, but he was getting a lot of questions. Can I have peanut butter when I'm cutting? Can I have this? Can I have that? And the common answer was, well, if it fits your macros, if it fits your macronutrients, then yes.
Yeah.
And so the coin was termed IFFYM.
Yeah.
And it seems to have got very, very popular in the recent couple of years. But I think the problem is with it, and you're very open about this, is that if you go on Instagram, it's full of like bodybuilders stuffing pizza and Pop-Tarts and donuts saying, yeah, bro, I'm a flexible dieter. When we all know that actually that's not the way. And the way is to eat quote unquote clean foods or whole foods 80% of the time. And then if you can fit a little bit of those foods into your plan, it works with you. It is going to prevent those sort of epic rebounds.
Yeah, I mean, the flexible dieting topic for me, you know, it's a bit like it's a dead horse and it's been beaten to death. But emotionally, I'm so invested in it because I used to be that guy who was super, super clean eating and then would have huge binges.
Yeah.
So for me, the concept of flexible dieting is great, as in it teaches people that you don't have to necessarily avoid anything if you can build it in. And everyone's, you know, everyone can interpret that and utilize that concept differently. But like you say, the issue is, it has become very almost pro junk food. So you go on Instagram, and if you go on like IFYM hashtag, it's pizzas, donuts, ice cream, all of this stuff. And a lot of the flexible dieters will say, you know, people don't understand that this isn't just about cramming as much shit into your diet as possible. But all they're doing is posting the shit in their diet. You know, very few of them are posting the chicken and vegetables they have for lunch.
Yeah.
And everyone is posting these fucking flex bowls with ice cream and M&Ms on top and all of that shit.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay, so you discovered this new way. You started to, learn more about tracking and things like that. And I think that, like I said, the first time I came across you was you did this whole video. It's brilliant because the way you talk is very sort of straight-laced. And then you were talking about sort of bulletproof coffee. And then you sort of finished up and you went, and for the best results, stay the fuck away from bulletproof coffee. And I thought, who is this guy? Like, and then because I was all for, you know, get the fat in your coffee, et cetera, et cetera. You did this epic video. I think it had a lot of hits, didn't it, dude?
Yeah, the bulletproof coffee one, well, I mean, like you're saying, like anyone that kind of listens to me, I'm quite deadpan and quite dry humour.
Yeah.
And never that animated, which doesn't work well for my YouTube channel.
Yeah.
But the whole bulletproof coffee thing was just, I don't know, I kind of had the revelation that I think sometimes if you inject a little bit of humour, it'll probably reach more people.
Yeah.
So, well, it naturally worked well for my own kind of sarcastic nature.
Yeah.
And for me, I just had this idea of doing a video on it because I saw people, it wasn't like adding the butter or oil to the coffee or whatever, like people had cream, so adding fat to coffee wasn't necessarily a huge new thing. But it was the whole people adding, I mean, literally I saw recommendations of up to 8 tablespoons of oil and butter in their coffee.
Yeah.
And it was like genuinely, I think it was the first time ever I even saw in a video, because I spent so long being, you know, Mr. Professional. I even avoided swearing because I thought that almost jeopardized professionalism. And it was the most popular video I'd ever done. It was only literally just over a minute long. And the kind of humor behind it and the shock factor and all of that stuff. And at the time, I think it had a couple of hundred shares, and my Facebook page was pretty small. So for me, that was kind of groundbreaking.
Yeah. And I think the thing is I remember, you know, we were sort of talking about bulletproof coffee, and lots of the lads enjoyed it. And then sort of got me questioning things. And you look at it and you go, oh, yeah, well, actually, if you're putting butter, coconut oil and MCT oil all in a coffee, yeah, there's some good fats in there, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. We know that. But you're probably turning a 20-calorie cup of black coffee into potentially a 500-600-calorie drink. And then you see people on Facebook and Instagram and they're having it with their oats. And you're like, bro, you've just done like 1,200 calories for breakfast. Like, by all means, if you want that coffee, that bulletproof coffee to be your breakfast with all that oil in, then go for it. But understand that you're basically just adding in 600 calories for no reason or because it's going to burn fat.
But I think it's the kind of like, it's the food halo effect where if you view something as healthy, then you're supposedly allowed to eat as much of it as you want.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, like, it's easy. I find it easy to make jokes about stuff that I have done personally.
Yes.
Because it feels like less like I'm attacking someone else's diet and more that I'm attacking something that I remember really having detrimental effects for me. So, you know, I used to be massive for this kind of food halo effect. It's like nuts are good for you. You can make such a good case for nuts being a healthy addition to someone's diet. But I used to literally eat them. I could eat half a kilo bag per day.
Mm.
And, you know, when nuts, you know, anything from kind of 500 to 650 calories per 100 grams, and I would literally eat half a kilo a day. But it's fine because nuts are good for you.
Yeah.
And that was how I justified it. So if food was good,
yeah,
I would eat it in unlimited quantity. So while I make jokes about people adding in coconut oil because they view it as a healthy fat, I make jokes because I did the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's really healthy. But you know, we were the same. We you say to guys, yeah, nuts, oils, all that kind of thing. And I remember one guy popping up in the program, and he'd actually lost a lot of timber simply because we'd got him off the sofa and got him moving, and he was a bigger guy. But then he couldn't understand why he plateaued and he'd stalled. And I said, right, send me your food diary. And it turns out he was eating like 300 grams of cashews a day.
Yep.
And I was like, yeah, it's good. They're great for your health, but obviously there's going to be a fuckload of calories in those. And it's funny because, you know, again, we're having an open conversation here, talk about things like almond butter, peanut butter, all those type of things. I mean, I could literally eat a whole tub. A whole jar of peanut butter, and it was clean, so it was healthy. What I didn't realise is there's about 1,200 calories probably in that. You still there, dude? Yeah.
Yeah, I thought I'd lost you from it. I heard you say 1,200 calories.
Yeah, there's probably about 1,200 calories in that jar of peanut butter, right?
Yeah.
And then
I did the same thing. I literally used to eat cashew butter by the jar.
Yeah.
But it's fine because nuts are good for you, and it's the same with things like oils.
Yeah.
You know, it gravitated towards that paleo side for me, that if something was natural, it was good for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, nuts and healthy oils and healthy fats, and you know, I used to eat an obscene amount. And I remember having the same conversation with someone who was probably 3 years behind me in terms of like learning curve.
Oh, and
he's a fellow personal trainer and still a really good friend of mine, but he does the stuff that I used to do. So we had the conversation. He said, you know, I'm following this low carb diet and I'm struggling to lose weight. And I said, look, I know you don't want to track everything, but if you did track just a couple of days, just see what totals you got and, you know, use it as what I call a dietary audit. And he worked out that he was having over 300 grams of fat per day.
Wow.
So he was eating, you know, 2,700 calories plus just from fat, not including the protein, small amount of carbs he was eating. And, you know, the guy was struggling to lose weight. And this was a guy who's a personal trainer, and he'd been a personal trainer for several years. So it's one of those... It's one of those things. It goes back to like the thing we discussed right at the beginning, like what mistakes did you make when you're a personal trainer? Like, this was a personal trainer that I considered better than a lot of people that I worked with, and he does the same stuff that I do. So this is, you know, me definitely not mocking him, but it makes you realize comparatively how little a lot of personal trainers know once you've been in the industry a while and you look back at mistakes you've made.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I remember sort of saying to clients, no, you can eat as much peanut butter as you want and as much almond butter because it doesn't spike your insulin. You know, it's like, get oil on everything, get the butter on it. You're having a flex there, and butter on it, and don't worry about it. Just whack it all on. Whereas now we understand that, it's great. It's healthy for you, but you're going to have to factor it in, as I like to say, right? So,
and
go on.
I mean, that is the big thing, is that if it's healthy, it's fine. And it wasn't if it's healthy, then maybe consume as much of it. It was if it's healthy, then it's fine. Eat as much of it as you want. And I did it, and I know people that do it, and I obviously he did it as well. But like you say, it definitely has a ceiling, and it can get out of control.
Sure. Okay, so one of the subsequent videos I remember watching of you was when you were at Body Power, and it was the great sort of the now famous, it was Alan Aragon versus Gary Taubes in a sort of debate, and you documented it. Now, look, let's be honest, right? You probably at one stage would have believed some of the stuff that Gary Taubes was saying, right?
Well, I mean, this is why I find the topic so fascinating, because I do have a personal interest in it.
Like,
I can make jokes and criticisms of low-carb dieting, but the reason I'm so involved with low-carb dieting mentally is because I did it for years.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Gary Taubes, in some ways, at least in terms of journalism, is a pioneer for low-carb dieting because he is so well-known in that circle.
Yeah.
So I found the whole kind of debate fascinating because he said things that a few years ago I believed, but hearing someone that had better science than he did, discussing it was kind of eye-opening for me, because if Gary Taubes had just done his presentation and I was still back in my low-carb days, I would have thought, I'm all over it, it makes perfect sense. But seeing someone who had a much more academic background kind of dispelling his myths was something I found really interesting. So it was one of the reasons I mentally got so kind of involved in it, because it's something that I spent years doing.
So tell me about how it went down. So tell me some of the stuff that, who opened up, and for the listeners, how did this whole thing evolve? It was it was meant to be a debate, right?
Yeah. So basically what happened, they both start with their own presentations. So they'll do, I think it was 20 minutes, one person talking, 20 minutes, the other person talking, and then some kind of back and forth questioning. And, Gary's presentation was, like I say, the kind of stuff that I would have believed at some point if I had just heard him. And he was very, very good at presenting. And to say that he could, in want of a better term, suck people into his story, if you will, I understand exactly why I would have got sucked in at some point, because he is a very, very good salesman and he presents very, very well. But when it came to the kind of back and forth on the questioning, it's almost kind of embarrassing to watch, because you had one guy literally saying, here's different types of research, here's some observational research, here are some RCTs and things like that, and going over all of this data. And Gary didn't reply with the data. He replied with his own kind of questions and theories and stuff like that. And it wasn't balanced.
No.
It was kind of awkward to watch, if I'm honest.
Yeah. So I think even Alan Aragon sort of got up and he said, look, I don't want to do this. He said, but if you were to hire anyone to get you in shape, would you hire me? Or would you hire Taubes? And obviously, Alan Aragon was in a lot better shape than Gary Taubes. But that was quite a big sort of turning point for me, seeing that as well, because Taubes was a sort of pioneer of this whole high fat, high protein, very, very low carb, and he basically got laughed out of town, right?
Pretty much. I mean, the thing is, the whole Epic Summit, it was called. The people that were going there were people that were interested in science, because they were there to listen to people discussing science.
Sure.
So when Gary Taubes came in and he gave his kind of presentation, and Alan gave his, you know, Alan actually citing research and then Gary citing his own theories, it didn't go well. And the thing is, like I say, if he was maybe presenting to a room full of people that enjoyed low-carb dieting and they were very, very heavily involved in low-carb diets, they would have probably lapped up everything that Gary had said.
Sure.
But because he literally didn't bring any research to the table, didn't cite any research studies, and then you've got Alan doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing, it was really, really kind of imbalanced. And, it's... The fun thing is, on the video that I did, I've had the worst comments of any video I've ever done.
Really?
On that one, because people that are involved in low carb dieting would see it and literally tear into me. I'd get loads of personal insults about it, how I must have been biased because Gary knows all the science and that type of thing. And people would literally say, you know, you obviously don't know who Gary Taubes is because his books are heavily referenced and that type of thing, and calling me biased on this. But the thing was, I was like, you weren't at the talk and you're telling me that my representation of the talk is biased. So I was like, which one of us is really the biased one here?
Mm-hmm. I think what we're talking about as well is, and we'll get onto this as we move on, as we draw towards the sort of last part of the podcast, is, Low carb diets work. We've recommended them. They work, and they are still very, very useful. But I think that as we evolve in the industry, it's important to show people there is another way. Okay, so again, if you read so like I said to you, Ben, before, we offer all different kinds of online programs for the masses, for over 30s men. And if you were to come into one of my 21, 28-day fat loss programs, we would put you in a low-carb diet initially. But then at the end of 28 days, we have a conversation with somebody and we sort of say, right, okay, you've learnt new good habits. You are eating more greens. You are eating more protein. You are maybe, you know, having your carbohydrates in and around your training. We've got you eating less takeaways, etc., etc. So there's some good habits been laid down. Now we can talk about where we want to go from here. So we're almost a little bit aggressive initially to get somebody moving. And then at, you know, 21, 28 days, we give them more options, right? So like I said to you, we're not here bashing low carb diets because they do work, but there is another way. So, and you know, you preach this other way now. So tell us an easier way to lose weight, Ben. And what you promote these days?
I actually, the thing with low carbs, and the reason I talk about them so much, it is absolutely not that low carb dieting is bad by any means, and it's not even a case that low carb dieting is worse. It's more of a case of, you don't have to have a phobia of carbohydrates.
Yes.
So low carb dieting is fine, and I still had clients that gravitate towards that as their personal preference. The reason why I talk about it is because I don't like people living in fear of carbohydrates when that's not necessary.
Yeah.
So I actually think that low carb dieting is very good from the angle that if you tell someone's gone a low carb diet, a lot of the time they will reduce their calories naturally. So this whole kind of like, if it fits your macros and counting all the macronutrients is great if that's what someone wants to do. But you know, the majority of people don't want to weigh everything they eat.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to be able to meet people at their level. So this new craze of everyone weighing everything and tracking everything is, I think, it's getting out of hand because, you know, I'm one of the most dedicated I know when it comes to fitness, and I don't want to weigh and track everything I eat.
Sure.
The idea of weighing and tracking every single thing that I eat just really, really doesn't appeal to me at all. So I actually think it's a good idea to have basic dietary recommendations that are relatively foolproof. So if you say to someone, reduce your carbs and go on a low carb diet, research has shown in a lot of instances that they will get better weight loss effects because just by telling someone to go on a low carb diet, they will often reduce their calories.
Yes.
So as a simple recommendation, I think it's great. With the caveat that you're not necessarily avoiding something that you have to avoid. It's just you know, another diet. And I think a lot of people get so hung up on one diet being best, always trying to find the best diet. Whereas in reality, it's like, well, here are a whole host of diets. All of them are going to work if they're calorie controlled.
Sure.
Pick the one that you think you're going to be able to stick to easiest.
This is really interesting because we talk about diets. And I know Martin McDonald, who I interviewed recently for the podcast, has come out. And he sort of says, look, all diets work, right? Diets work because they put you in a calorie deficit. So it's not that, you know, you might have done Herbalife, you lost a load of weight. Well, it's not Herbalife, you're in a calorie deficit.
Yeah.
You've done the ketogenic diet, you lost a load of weight. It's not the fact that you didn't have any carbs, it's you were in a calorie deficit. You did the Cambridge diet, you know, you were in a calorie deficit. All diets work, right? But the reason people regain weight afterwards is because we're not taught what to do after we come off that diet, right?
Yeah.
So it's about, you know, if I think that people are, look, you can go on an aggressive weight loss diet, right? Let's say you decide to be really, really aggressive, and we'll talk about deficits in a second. But let's say, you know, you lose 20 pounds. The problem is that people then go back to eating the way they were when they were 20 pounds heavier, and yet they haven't done the calculation on their new weight and the fact that now they're 20 pounds lighter, they actually need less calories to survive. Yeah. So Martin put up a great post recently which said, look, you know, some people, and not all, can go pretty aggressive on a deficit. They can do it. And at some point, I know we talk a lot about balance in this industry now, but some people don't want balance. They want it hard. They want it fast. But then they need to be shown how to maintain afterwards at their new weight. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I think the whole kind of crash dieting thing, you know, people view it as, let's say, an easy example is like the cabbage soup diet,
sure,
or something like that, where you go on a very, very extreme diet for a set period of time, but then that period of time finishes and you don't know what to do. So I know people that will have gone, say, a meal replacement diet, do it for, say, 4 weeks, lose a huge amount of weight, but they only ever viewed that diet as a temporary measure because they're obviously not going to live on meal replacement shakes the rest of their life.
Sure.
So, like you say, they go back to how they were eating before and wonder why the weight piles on. So the thing with crash dieting, or let's say aggressive dieting, it's certainly not bad. You know, getting people results and, you know, trying to give them something that they're going to stick to and try and build up some momentum because they're actually seeing results is potentially a great thing. The caveat to that is they have to know what to do when they finish it.
Yeah.
Because if you go on a crash diet but you're planning on doing it for 4 weeks and then going back to how you were eating before, you're going to be in for a bad time, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. So talking about, you know, calories and calorie deficits, things like that, I mean, I've started to talk about it a lot in my generic plans now. And, you know, I've been saying to guys recently that I've seen in my plans that have lost a shed load, but then they've put it all back on. You know, why don't you look at a more softly approach, you know, look to lose a pound a week, stay in a 500 calorie deficit a day, 7 days a week. You can enjoy your, you know, a little bit of flexibility, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to do a 1,000 calorie a day deficit, you know, you do that 7 days, you're on for 2 pounds a week. People don't think that's sexy, but, you know, the less the deficit, the easier it is to maintain. And I said to somebody the other day, I said, look, if you lost a pound a week for the rest of the year, you're going to lose like 40 pounds or something, whatever it is, right? But people want it quick. They want it really, really quick. And you've got to find that balance, right? Some people want it really quick. So do you aggressively diet them and then show them, you know, how to go back to eating according to their new weight? Or do you show them the slow and steady route? I mean, if we're talking about deficits, calorie deficits on a daily basis, where do you sit with your sort of average deficit for the sort of Joe public?
See, the thing with weight loss, like you said, is that slow weight loss isn't sexy.
Yeah.
So most people don't want to lose weight. You know, if they want to lose 15 pounds, 20 pounds or whatever, most of people are going to try and do it as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Whereas if you say, you know, you could lose half a pound a week, you know, that doesn't appeal to people because it looks like it's dragging the pain out over a longer period of time. But that is because you're looking at dieting as just that dieting time frame rather than what happens afterwards. Yeah. So, you know, losing weight very, very quickly and then struggling to keep it off. Like, people think, oh, I'll diet for 4 weeks and then I'm done. But, you know, dieting success to me isn't measured by how much weight you lose in that period of time. It's more how easily did you keep it off? Did you actually keep it off? So you might have dieted for 4 weeks, but what did you weigh a year later, for example? So I kind of view the success of a diet on how much someone weighs after the diet and then after that, yeah, rather than just the dieting phase itself. So when it comes to deficits for me, I think some people will want fast weight loss, and they might need to see something quickly to be able to stick with it. And other people perhaps are less fussed.
Yeah.
So I think it will boil down to the personal preferences, sure, like personal psychology.
Yeah.
Also, you know, if someone's dieting for a purpose. So I've had clients that say, I want to lose X amount of weight for a wedding. I don't care if the weight comes back on afterwards because I just want to look good for that day.
Really? That's interesting. Yeah. Really interesting.
So, you know, it's how you view it. Some people would prefer to get the fastest results possible for a certain day, like, say, bodybuilders or something dieting for a contest. For a wedding day, for example, where they want to be the slimmest they've ever been but don't anticipate staying there for the rest of their life. Or if they just want to be in the best shape they can be for the rest of their life, in which case, just adopting a better lifestyle.
Yeah.
Even if the results are slow, it's fine because you're doing it for the rest of your life. It's staying in good shape all the time,
yeah,
rather than dieting and, you know, ending your diet on June the 1st or whatever you've counted in the diary.
Yeah, I think it comes down to you've got to find what works for you. Whether, you know, like you said, whether it is that somebody has said, yeah, I've got a wedding in 7 weeks. I'm prepared to go, you know, I'm prepared to suffer somewhat just to get to that day. Or actually, I'm looking to be in the best shape of my life or be in the best shape in the last couple of years by the end of the year. And you can, yeah, do something a bit more slow and steady. Because I've said to people before that have really struggled, I see them, they lose huge amounts of weight initially and then it's all come back on. I'm like, why don't you just focus on a pound a week? You know, you could lose a pound a week quite easy. And you could still go out for, you know, a 3-course meal on a Saturday night with your missus. Just make sure that you're increasing your NEAT, or you might even want to use some intermittent fasting. And it's pretty easily done, right?
Mm-hmm.
So look,
yeah,
Ben, we've been talking now for a good hour. I want to go for about another 5 to 10 minutes. Going to talk about a few more things. Keeping on the nutritional tracks here, what are your views on intermittent fasting for weight loss?
My simplified view on it is it's a time-restricted method of caloric control. So if, for example, someone likes having bigger dinners, then they might reduce the number of calories or even fast for X number of hours to allow themselves a bigger meal in the evening.
I actually saw you said you actually like to eat your biggest meals in the evening, don't you? So do you mini fast in the day or?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is for me, I try and make my dieting as effortless as possible. So if I have personal preferences, I try and gear my diet towards that, you know, rather than making it more painful. So for me, if I'm working and if I'm busy, if I'm out of the house, I often won't think about food. So especially if I'm doing work trips or I'm in another country, I almost go on autopilot mode and I'm focused on that and I won't think about eating as much. But when I'm at home, it's completely different. So for example, I could have, say, a bowl of porridge for breakfast and then not eat for hours and hours and hours and hours. But the moment I come back home, I'll start thinking about dinner. So I can go from not even considering food to, oh my God, I'm starving.
Yeah.
So for me, if I come home and I'm sitting on the sofa, you know, with the girlfriend watching the TV or something, to me, that's when I end up eating the most because, you know, I think it's partly a boredom thing. It's mindless eating. You're watching the TV, yeah, you're tuning out and you're stuffing your face, basically. So for me, it's like, if my calories are getting too high, where do I cut them down from? So do I cut them down from a certain period of the day? Do I make all of my meals smaller? Do I make certain days smaller, like eat less calories on a weekend or whatever it is? But for me, it's more of a case of, I think eating's quite a social thing for my family. So I've always grown up, like, when you're with people, you will often sit and talk over dinner. So for me, I like to keep that. Yeah. So if I go out for dinner with friends, I like to have that meal as close to a, you know, normal dinner as possible. So if they want to go out for a takeaway and a few beers, I want to be able to do that. So for me, it's much easier to say, well, I'll eat less calories elsewhere.
I like this.
Because I value that more than, you know, the breakfast I'm eating on my own, for example.
Yeah.
So yeah, for me, my kind of priorities are how I act around other people, because I still like to enjoy having a social life. Yeah. And, you know, I did that whole thing on going out for dinners with friends, but taking my own food. And whilst I know people that still do it, and, you know, if they're fine with it, then they're fine. But I didn't like that for me.
Yeah.
I prefer, you know, actually feeling involved in eating what other people are eating and enjoying the kind of the social occasion.
Sure. And it is interesting because you can do that, right? I mean, like I said, I was talking to a guy on one of our retreats. And I said, look, you still can go out and enjoy a couple of glasses of wine, 3-course meal on Saturday night. Why not just fast till then? Why not do 10,000 steps till then? And the next day, you know, you can go a little bit less calories and again, just increase your activity the following day. And I think it's about that balance. I remember, Ben, you did a post. It must have been about 18 months ago or something. You talked about you went on a lad's holiday to Ibiza. And you said you drank alcohol every day, but actually you didn't, for once, you didn't beat yourself up. You actually really enjoyed it.
It was a funny thing for me, because I did come from this like hardcore bodybuilding mentality background. Mm. I barely ever touched alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, you don't find a lot of bodybuilders that drink alcohol a lot, because it's, you know, an empty source of calories. So I genuinely went on holiday feeling apprehensive. It was the first ever lads' holiday I'd been on. I barely touched alcohol, literally for about 8 or 9 years before that, like 3 glasses of wine a year on average.
Wow.
So going on a stag do for 7 days, I genuinely thought, fucking hell, how am I going to cope with this? And I remember being genuinely a bit anxious about it.
Mm.
And then I went out there, and it was a turning point for me, because I drank more alcohol in that 7 days than I had in literally 9 years leading up to it. But I had the best week of my life.
Yeah.
And it made me realize how shit my work-life balance was, because I was so fitness-based that I felt anxious about going on a holiday with my friends.
Yeah.
And it was a massive penny drop moment for me, because it really made me reevaluate my you know, my work-life balance.
That's a great nugget there, Ben. And I think you're absolutely right. We've all, you know, when we're in this sort of modality or this mindset of, right, I'm on a diet, I'm this, I'm that. And you start thinking about social occasions going, I can't go there, fuck. I can't, yeah. And you're saying, you know, you're taking Tupperware everywhere. And there comes a point where you actually think, fuck, just step back for a second. You know, what do I value more? And I think that comes as we evolve and you get a little bit older. It's like, you know, you've turned 30 now, and I expect you're a lot more relaxed than you used to be when you were like 20, right?
Yeah. See, I think one of the big things is a lot of people, when they diet, it is very binary. You're dieting or you're not. So I'm dieting for 4 weeks and that's it. And people view it as like a yes or no, black and white thing. So for example, I've got clients that, you know, that they might apologize if they go out, they went out drinking and they feel like they've let themselves down because that isn't part of their diet. But rather than focusing on the stuff you should exclude, like a lot of people think, when I'm dieting, I'm not going to eat this, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to go out and see my friends. And they try and adopt a completely different lifestyle to what they're doing every day. So to me, it's like, don't focus on the stuff you're excluding. Focus on how you can include that, but still hit your goals. So rather than thinking, I'm never going out drinking with my friends, try and plan a strategy so you can still go out drinking with your friends, but you are still, you know, getting the result that you want.
So give us a couple of strategies, what you would give, Ben, as we get towards the last stages. Because I actually, you know, a lot of my clients, they love a pint. And I'm not going to change them, unfortunately. I long gave up on thinking I could change every one of my clients. All I can do is assist, advise, and help in as much as I can. So let's say you've got there's a guy here, listen to this, he's dieting or he's wanting to lose weight, but he still wants to go out and have a couple of beers on a Saturday night with his mates. What would your tactics be to get around that?
See, I used to do the thing where you would tell people not to do something. And like you say, you can't change everyone. But over time, it made me think I'm actually focusing too much on changing them at all. Because to me, trying to get someone not to do something, you know, if that's part of part and parcel of their lifestyle, then, you know, perhaps, like you say, it's actually better not to try and change that at all.
Yeah.
So for me, for example, if I've got clients that like going out drinking on the weekend, it's how much are they drinking? Could they swap drink for something lower calorie, for example? Like if someone's worried about their waistline and they go from drinking beers to drinking spirits, they could save calories. So if they enjoy drinking, maybe that's a viable strategy. Alternatively, if they say, look, I'm having 10 pints on a Saturday night and you can fuck off if you think I'm going to change that, then, you know, look external to that. So, you know, could they drop their calories in the week, perhaps, and then keep that night as it is? Or are they able to exercise enough where, you know, that isn't a problem? And
yeah.
I think on the whole, it is trying to adopt a strategy that suits that person. You know, for a lot of people, exercise is, you know, a chore that they have to kind of build in. It's easy for me, who kind of enjoys exercise, to talk about it differently. But for a lot of people, it's just trying to balance it and for them have a lifestyle that they enjoy. So I think one of the best things that I've done with people is help them make their own choice.
Yeah.
So rather than saying, okay, you can't have this, or you should have this, or you can go out drinking, but this, like, you know, if someone wants to drink 10 pints of beer and they're not going to swap it for spirits, then fine. You know, it's perhaps silly for me to try and get them to change if they know they're not going to change.
Sure.
So it's like, if this is a habit that they enjoy and they're not going to switch it, then try and find a way to build it in, whether it's dropping calories elsewhere or upping exercise somewhere else, or you know, whatever it is.
I think this is really interesting, because I saw your video recently on NEAT, and all the trainers are talking about it. Guys, if you just listen this week, it's non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So basically, it's the calories you burn just doing day-to-day shit. We've actually introduced something, Ben, in our six-week program at the minute called Beat My NEAT. Basically, it's just getting guys moving. And it's fucking great because we've got guys walking to work, going for a walk in their lunch break, they're taking the stairs, they're, you know, walking the kids to school. And, you know, quite often, Simon Hall said this on a recent podcast. He said people will go out and have 10 pints on a Saturday night, but then they'll sit in their own shit on a Sunday and eat crap and just wallow. When actually, what if you'd have gone, do you know what, I've had 10 pints, okay, I feel not great, but I'm going to get up, I'm going to hydrate, and I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to get out there in the elements. I'm going to get my 10,000 steps in. Maybe have a run around with the kids, kick a ball, go to the park, and go a little bit lower calorie today. And actually, guess what? You got to Monday, and the damage that you did on Saturday has actually been eradicated because you haven't sat in your own shit on a Sunday. You've actually gone out. And it doesn't have to be this high-intensity interval training, going to the gym and pounding yourself. It could just be a 2-hour, a 1-hour walk with the family, the dog, the kids, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, I mean, people have got this misconception that most of the calories they burn are in the gym. So if they eat more food, they go to the gym. But, you know, the mass majority of the calories that you burn on a day-to-day basis aren't inside the gym at all. So a lot of people, the amount of calories they burn from working out is, you know, relatively small, like a couple of hundred to a few hundred maybe. But having an active lifestyle in general, I'm burning calories sitting here, obviously not a huge amount. So I think encouraging people to be more active in general can be a great way for people to burn more calories without even thinking about burning more calories.
Yeah, interesting, dude. Okay, Ben, look, we're going to wrap up in a couple of minutes. It's been great vibe, been really good talking to you, mate. Before we go, we're going to put you on the spot, and I'm going to ask you 3 fitness nutrition myths that need to die. Pretty sharpish. 3. Go for your life.
Fitness and nutrition, or just nutrition?
Go for nutrition, dude.
Well, because we've talked about it so much, the idea that you have to cut carbs to lose weight is one that I would love to see go. I would love to see people stopping being afraid of the word chemicals. Like, if you can't pronounce it on the label, then don't eat it.
Go into that, because I saw your video and I've put my hands up, dude. I've shared a meme 4 years ago of, you know, there's not enough people counting, too many people the counting calories, not enough counting chemicals.
The thing for me is the word chemical has a very, very bad view on it. but literally everything you eat, everything is made of chemicals. It's comprised of chemicals. So if you look at the back of something like a junk food, you will often see things on the label that you don't know what they are. Mm. So therefore, there obviously must be bad things because it's junk food, and junk food can't be as good for you. And generally speaking, you know, that's fine. So eating less processed food is still a good nutrition tip. But being afraid of the word chemicals, and you know, if you can't pronounce it, then don't eat it, is a very, very tenuous jump from there, because, you know, a lot of people can't pronounce, you know, vitamins and minerals in their long name form. Mm. So avoiding something because you can't pronounce it is crazy, because there are loads of things that are good for you that people won't be able to read or know what they are when they look on the label.
Yeah. Comes down to the calories, right?
Yeah, and this whole kind of avoiding chemical thing, like, you know, there's certainly a, you could make a good case for it, because if you're eating natural food most of the time, chances are there isn't going to be a massively extensive ingredients list compared to something like a McDonald's milkshake, which will have a long ingredients list. But saying that all chemicals are bad for you is crazy.
Third
nutrition myth. This is because I was going to make a tweet on it. So although it's not that important, I do think it's kind of funny. You know, 10 years ago or however many years ago, people said don't eat carbs after 6 p.m. You know, because of insulin, you're not going to burn off the carbs that you eat and all of that. And we've managed to reverse it. And now we're intermittent fasting and we're carb backloading and things like that. And I know people now to do the exact thing we did 10 years ago, except now it's after 6 p.m.
Yeah.
So because of carb backloading, it's like, well, no, due to best insulin sensitivity, maybe you should eat your carbs after 6 p.m. Mm. And they've got to the point where they avoid carbs up until that point.
Wow.
And I just find it funny how the fitness industry's got like this kind of pendulum where people go from one thing and go, well, actually, maybe that's not true.
Yeah.
And then completely go in the opposite direction.
It is mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so there you have it, guys. Ben, we actually ended up speaking for 1 hour and 15 minutes. Dude, it's been a real pleasure. We'd not even spoken, had we, in person before. We've not met. Reached out to you, and you said you'd be happy to do it. I thought that went really well, buddy. So, Ben, before we finish up, tell the listeners where they can find out more about you, where they can follow you. Guys, honestly, you have to follow Ben on YouTube, because he talks exactly like he does now, but he's very, very witty and sarcastic in the way that he dispels common myths. So it's really, really funny. Ben, where can we find you on social media, dude?
So YouTube is youtube.com/ Ben Carpenter. Facebook is / Ben Carpenter personal training, and those are the ones I'm most active on. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter. Both of those are BDC Carpenter.
BDC. And what have you got coming up, buddy, for the rest of 2017?
Honestly, I'm not sure yet. I have a really busy couple of months with Expo, so we've got there's FIBO and FitCon and Body Power coming up and stuff like that. So I need to get the next 60 days behind me before I can strategize to the rest of the year, I think.
So you're going to be at Body Power, yeah?
Yeah, I'll be freestyling. I'm not working a stand or anything, but I'll be there. And, you know, it's nice to meet people that you often only see on social media. So yeah. I like going to expos.
Absolutely, dude. All right, and buddy, well, listen, it's been really good talking to you, Ben. Lads, I really hope you get some value from that. Like Ben said, you can find him on YouTube. You find him on Twitter, Instagram. He's everywhere.
Bloody everywhere.
That's how I found him. Yeah, and yeah. Make sure you go and watch his video on Bulletproof Coffee. It's fucking epic, guys. Ben, thanks so much for coming on, my friend.
My pleasure.
We'll stay on now after and have a little chat. But guys, this was episode 18 or 19. We're coming at you thick and fast. That was with Ben Carpenter. It's been a real pleasure having him on. Hope you got some value from that, guys. If you liked it, please give us a share, leave us a comment on iTunes. We really appreciate it. So, guys, wherever you are, thanks again for listening, and keep trucking.